Last week, we spoke about Mahadran buses from the perspective of separation, of segregation of genders. And we spoke about the fact that genders are differentiated in halacha because of the natural attraction that exists between two genders. And we spoke about this in terms of shuls, potentially schools, and then buses. And we pointed out that perhaps there is room in certain occasions for segregated buses, depending on the context and the place. But we also pointed out Rav Moshe Feinstein's tshuva, where he permits sitting on a bus because it's incidental contact. So that was in terms of last week. And what we spoke about, the fact was that, in general, we have found no distinctions thus far between men and women in these areas. It goes equally back and forth between men and women in terms of the separation. Now, it's important to note, and I think it's pretty well accepted and well understood, that men and women are different in this regard as well. Now, some might debate this, but I think it's pretty common knowledge. If I gave you, and it's right before source 14, just a little selection here, you can read the rest of the book by yourselves if you haven't already. Men are from Mars, women are from Venus. Understanding the fact that men and women are different changes the way that these laws, these guidelines, these safety valves of halacha in terms of separating the genders to avoid any problematic relationships, they're going to play out sometimes differently between men and women because men and women are different. I should send you, after this year, if you'd like, a link to a YouTube clip that someone sent me. There's an amateur filmmaker in the University of Utah who stands outside the library at the university, and he takes a poll. He takes a poll. If men and women can just be friends. That's the question. Can men and women just be friends? What's that? So, you're talking to the audience here is... The audience who is being interviewed are college students in the University of Utah. And he takes this microphone, this amateur, and I can send it to you. It's fabulous. And he interviews the first woman who walks in, the young woman. She says, yeah, why not? Men and women can be friends. And the second one and the third one. And then he interviews the next guy who walks into the library. And the guy's like, but... Then he goes back, the next woman who walks by, we can be friends, men and women. Every woman that walked past that microphone said, yeah, men and women can be friends. Every single guy who walked past the microphone could not say yes with a straight face. Could not. And he ends the clip by saying, okay, we have proved that in reality, men and women cannot be just friends. Maybe from the women's perspective they can, but the men's perspective, it's just different. And what's interesting is that the halacha recognizes that men's hard wiring is different than that of women. Now, sometimes it's equal, but it's interesting in the way that's formulated. I'll give you an interesting example, and that is source 14. There is a din in Shulchan Aruch, in Hilchos Avelos. Avel Asur B'tash B'shamita. There is no marital intimacy during Shiva, during Avelos. Aval, Bishar, Dvar Kurva, other closeness, Mutar, it's permitted, Afilu b'meziga sakos, pouring the wine, stirring the wine, Vahatsoa samita, making the bed comfortable, Varchatsas panav yalta viraglov, washing face, hands, and feet, Bain ba'avelas didei, Bain ba'avelas dida. Irrespective if he is in Avelas or she is in Avelas. So the Shach, Reb Shabzik Kohen, who's the classic commentary on the side of the Shulchan Aruch, asks, well, why does it matter whether he's in Avelos or she's in Avelos? The Shach says, I'll tell you why. Because the way that men operate is different than the way women operate. So he quotes two different ways of looking at this. One's from the pre-show, which is a commentary on the tour, and one is from the Shach himself. The first is the pre-show. He says, Afilu ba'avelos dida. The Chiddush is, even though she's in Avelos, de'ikal amechash yoser, we should be concerned more hol v'hu eino ovel. We'll allow these activities, making the bed, or all these different kinds of activities, they're allowed even though she's in Avelos. Why? Because if he's not an Avelos, we have a greater concern that he will be involved in a level of intimacy. And the Shach says, no, that's not the Pshat. The opposite. We should be more concerned when he is in Avelos. Because if she's not in Avelos, maybe she'd be more willing to go along, and he will violate the laws of Avelos that are incumbent upon him. Why? Because his desire is different than hers. So it's interesting to me when I saw this halacha, it's that even though at the end game the Avelos is the same in terms of halacha for his Avelos and for her Avelos, but the perspective is different because the halacha recognizes that men and women are different. This extends to another area which is debated. We talked last week about the mechitza in shul. Well, what the function is somewhat debated. There is an opinion of the Rambam, which is here in source 14 Aleph, in that Mishnah and Sukkah that we mentioned last week regarding in mechitza in the Beis HaMikdash, which is the source, the model of mechitza in our shul, wrote Lomar, Gadol HaToeles, what's that? They used to make a great fixing in the Beis HaMikdash. Ki ha'am hayu misaknim makom la'anashim, makom l'anashim, separate places for men and separate places for women. U'makom ha'anashim l'maylo mimakom ho'anashim. They would put the women's gallery up above the men's gallery. Why? So that the men shouldn't look at the women. The women can look at the men, but the man can't look at the women. Yes.
Going back to what you said about Avelot, I'm a little bothered by it.
Yeah.
My misunderstanding, it sounds to me like you're diminishing woman during Avelot.
No, we're saying that the laws are equal whether or not he's an Avelos or she's an Avelos. They're allowed to, let's say, if a couple is in a status of nida, they're not allowed to serve each other a cup. I can't pour my wife a cup of water and she can't pour it for me. However, so the Shulchan Aruch says, when they're in Avelos, you're allowed to do that. Even though there is some level of intimacy, and when a woman is in nida, they're not allowed to do it for each other, man for woman. But when they're in Avelos, it's permitted. And the Shulchan Aruch tells you, it doesn't matter whether it's the woman to the man or the man to the woman, it's equal. And the point of the Shulchan Aruch is to say, don't think that we should be more concerned about the man because his desires are stronger. We say the playing field is equal. But he's trying to explain what we would have said. Not what we say, but what we would have said, that we should be more stringent on the man because we need to curb his desires. We don't say that. At the end of the day, it's equal. The din of Mezigas HaKos, Harchatz HaSpon of Yad Raglav. But the Chiddush, says the Shach, is that we have to take into account, the halacha recognizes that men operate differently. That's the Chiddush. Make sense? Okay.
Is that the rationale behind Kol Isha as well?
So it could be the rationale behind Kol Isha. That's certainly a possibility. We know the Gemara says in Brachos that there are certain things that are considered an erva. They are Kol Isha. So then there are discussions, different parts of women that are exposed. Now, this is in part of the concept of tznius that we spoke about, alluded to last week from Dr. Lamb, that tznius is a universal aspect, but it's going to play out differently for different people in different contexts. The same way that in different societies, tznius in how you make a wedding is going to be measured differently. You know, a wedding that we have today that's considered a modest wedding, if you were to make that wedding in Europe 75, 80 years ago, you would have been considered the wealthiest person in Poland. So a lot of tznius is subjective based on the time. Part of tznius is objective based on the statements of Chazal. We'll get to that in a little bit in terms of an important distinction. But the idea that halacha recognizes that men and women are different is important. Now, I believe last week, I sent you an article that was published in the New York Times by Rabbi Dov Linzer, who argued his main point is to say that according to Jewish tradition, when there's an issue of tznius, the Talmud says to the men, it's your problem, sir, not hers. That's how he presents it. The whole issue, according to him, of... Let me see if I brought it with me tonight. What's that? I didn't send it to you? Okay, Belin Nader. I only sent you the Harel article. Okay. So I have to send it to you. This was in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago. And He argues the point that this whole thing in Beit Shemesh is all out of control because the men have to take care. They're responsible for their own things. They shouldn't look at things they're not supposed to look at. And everybody's responsible for themselves. It's the men's problem, not the women's. That's what he writes. Then, I can send you this other article that was published online by a professor of modern Jewish history, the J. and Jeannie Schottenstein, professor of modern Jewish history at the University of Indiana, Bloomington, who's a rabbi, says he's a rabbi in Seaview, New York. Sounds like somewhere on Long Island. I don't know where it is. He's not Orthodox. Forget his name offhand. I didn't bring it tonight. Who says, excuse me, Rabbi Linzer, I commend you for what you have to say, but if what you're saying is true, then take down the mechitza. And do away with all the restrictions on physical interaction between the genders. Because if it's the men's problem, so tell them not to look. And the truth is that neither of them is 100% right, but maybe together they're 100% right. Because in my humble opinion, Rabbi Linzer's argument that it's the men's responsibility to take care of where they look and what they see is only half true. It's only half true, because the other argument is very cogent. On the other hand, to say that it's not anybody's responsibility, we don't believe that either. So what do we believe? Well, I think we believe that there is a notion of shared responsibility, individual and communal. Maybe if we are very entrenched in a self-absorbed libertarian perspective that says that all I worry about in the world is me, so then maybe then we could say, you know, to heck with the next guy. What do I care? But in Jewish society, that's not the case.
Very selfish.
It's not the case. We have individual responsibilities, and then we have collective responsibilities. What kind of community do we want to create? And this is manifest on multiple levels. There's no such thing as in Jewish law saying, you know, I don't care what happens to you. The Gemara tells us in Source 15, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Chav Zayin Amud Beis, V'choshlu ish ba'achiv, a person will stumble, they will trip up with their brother. What does that mean? Ish ba'avon achiv, a man in the sin of their brother, melamed shekulon arevim zebaze. All Jews are mutually responsible. That means that I can't just say, well, I'm going to live my life, act the way I want, behave the way I want, and I don't care what's going to happen to the next person. The fact that the next person has such and such a makeup, a predisposition, what do I care? No, I care. We could spend a lot more time talking about this, but this is very practical. It's very important for us every single day. I am interconnected with you to the point where if you didn't hear Kiddush yet on Shabbos, and I heard Kiddush already, so I'm not mechuyev anymore, I can still make Kiddush for you. Ma pitom, we have a rule. If I'm not mechuyev, if I'm not obligating something, I can't help you discharge your obligation. But the answer is, because if you didn't hear Kiddush yet, I haven't yet completely fulfilled my Kiddush. And therefore, if you didn't hear the shofar, even though I did, I could blow the shofar for you again. You didn't hear Mikra Megillah, I could say Mikra Megillah again. Because we're connected. And vice versa. The Gemara has an extensive discussion in Avodah Zarah based on the Pasuk in Source 16, V'lifnei Iver Lo Sitei Michshol. I can't put up a stumbling block in front of somebody else. If I behave in a way that I know is going to influence somebody else, so that's not okay. What do we say? I say, what do I care? A guy comes to ask me for a ham sandwich. What do we say? What do I care? Give him the ham sandwich. No! Livnei Iver Lo Sitei Michshol. So I think, yes, it's the man's responsibility to watch what he's looking at, but as the Rama pointed out in the Pirush of Mishnayos, as a society, we have to set up what we think are reasonable and appropriate guidelines based on halacha, how to safeguard everyone. So I think that's an important thing. Yes, Doctor.
I don't know if you're going to mention it, but Nefesh HaChaim goes so far as to say that if you do a mitzvah here in Chicago, someone on the other side of the world is going to benefit.
Beautiful. Whole world. Everybody benefits. Beautiful. So now, this whole issue about taking the buses and segregating the buses really gets to a larger issue because it was related to something that was in the news after that in Israel about a woman who was supposed to speak at a Ministry of Health event, and there was a big discussion whether she was going to speak or not speak. It was a big tumult. And it has to do in general with, it's not just the role of the women on the bus, role of women in general in Judaism. And this is obviously a super sensitive topic. And the fact that nobody was offended last week and you still came back means that we're still pretty much on safe ground until this point.
You're not guaranteeing.
No guarantee. I'm just saying we're just going to keep going. We'll see what happens. And that is one thing we have to understand and we have to come to terms with if we want to. But that's our choice. But if we want to know what traditional Judaism has to say, the notion of different roles for different people is something that's not just incidental to Judaism, it's part of Judaism. Different roles in general. I'll give you an example. If you look on the next page, you see a beautiful diagram here that you'll find in the Kahati Mishnayis of the Beis HaMikdash. How many people in here are Kohanim, men worthy to serve in the Beis HaMikdash, in the Avoda? I'm the only one. Anyone who has Truma. You know my address. So if you're looking on this picture, the right-hand side of the picture is the western section of the Beis HaMikdash, where you'll find the Kodesh Kodashim, the Kodesh, and then the Mizbeach in the middle. If you look just to the left of the Mizbeach, oh, look at this! It's right here! I didn't even realize we had it in the room. Look at this. All right, we've got the diagram. This is the Mizbeach. This section, beginning here, going all the way back here, is called the Ezras Kohanim. That's the section of the Beis HaMikdash, which is reserved only for Kohanim. Period. End of story. Any Levium?
Vasily.
There we go, Vasily. Dr. Spindel.
Yes.
No.
You're good, right?
I'm the wife.
Okay, but I have to just tell you something.
I can't go.
No go. No go. Okay, this right here is called the Duchan. This is where the Kohanim stand. Who goes in this little area, right this tiny skinny zone? That's called Ezras Yisrael. Doc, you want to go? That's your place. You want to go bring a Korban Pesach? You're only allowed in there. That's a distinction. And that's a fundamental part of the Kedushas Beis HaMikdash, is that there are distinctions. Maybe this is patterned after the Jewish experience at Sinai, where Moshe Rabbeinu was allowed in one particular area. Others, Aaron was allowed somewhere else, the Zekanim was somewhere else. There are different roles. The Kohanim have one role, and the Levim have a different role, and the Yisraelim have a different role.
So
furthermore,
is there a place there for a while?
Yes, yeah. This whole area called the Ezras Nashim.
Okay.
The balcony.
Well, what else?
Well, the balcony was only during Sukkot, meaning during the rest of the year, what Moshe points out in that Shuva, women came here, let's say they had to bring korbanos, so they would come here to the entrance so that they could see their korban being brought right there. The Yisraelim could go just a little bit right there.
What are the separate squares on each corner?
These are different rooms. So this is what's called the Lishkas HaMitzorayim. This is the Lishkas HaShmonim, where they had oils. This is where they took care of any korbanos for Nazirim. This is where they kept the wood. This is the dormitory. Right here, the Beis HaMokid, this is the Kohanim dormitory. And this was the Lishkas HaGazus, where the Sanhedrin lived. We could spend a whole year studying this. Anywhere. On a rotating basis, they had a dormitory. Who was serving in that day? Anyway, so I'm a Kohen, right? Let's say we all decided... We all decided we had a great idea. You know what? We came up with a great idea. Actually, I came up with this great idea. You know what? How about I became the Melech? Not bad, right? Rosh Kolol, pretty good. Melech, even better.
Pays more.
Pays more, quite. Is that okay? Thumbs up or thumbs down? It's a no-go. Bingo. Wrong shaven. Like it or not, I could be the most apt leader, but I'm not going to be the king. That's just the way it is. I'm not going to be the king. You have to be from Shevet Yehuda. Says the Ramban in Source 17. You want to know why the Chashmonaim, as righteous as they were at the beginning, as heroic as they were, at the end of several generations, they were gone. Disappeared. You want to know why? Because they went from being Kohanim to being Malachim, to becoming kings. And Ramban says, big no-no. You got to understand, if you're a Kohen, you're a Kohen. That's one role. If you're a Melech, that's another role. You can't be a Kohen, you can't be also a Melech. It just doesn't go. So in society today, people are not comfortable with this idea. But in Yiddishkeit, that's essential to what we believe. It's not democratic in the sense that everything is for everyone. Not everything is for everyone. And some parts of it are tragic. Rachmana Litzlan, a mamzer, someone who's born from a particular type of inappropriate, illicit relationship, that child is a mamzer, rachmana litzlan. That child is going to have a very hard life. They won't be able to marry most women, or vice versa. Women won't be able to. That's a tragedy. But that's part of the system.
They can marry, though?
They can marry only a mamzeres, or the Gemara has a very convoluted story with an Eved and a Shivcha Kananis, which is a whole other story. Now, does that mean that the Melech is better than I am, because he's a Melech?
No, it comes from a different...
It's a whole different story. That's the Mishnah in Horios. It's a very interesting Mishnah. The Mishnah itself is very interesting on a number of levels. The Mishnah says, in 18, Kohen Kodim Lelevi. If you have two people drowning in the pool, and you can only save one of them, only one, the Kohen comes before the Levi. And the Levi before the Yisrael. And the Yisrael before the Mamzer. And the Mamzer before the Nasin. And the Nasin before the Ger. And the Ger before the Evan Meshucharim. Amasai, says the Mishnah, when is this? Bizman Shekulam Shavin, when they're all equal. Aval Imhaya Mamzer Talmud Chacham, the Kohen Gadol Amaretz. Mamzer Talmud Chacham, Kohen, Kodim, the Kohen Gadol Amaretz. I could have the biggest yichus in the world, but if I'm an Am Aretz, the next guy's a Talmud Chacham, who cares that I'm a Kohen, he's a Mamzer? Who cares, says the Mishnah. So just because we have different roles doesn't mean that I'm any better than him or he's any better than me. Now there's an unbelievable Gemara, which we could spend a lot more time discussing, but just a regal achas, the Gemara teaches us that where there are Bali Tshuva, now, Bali Tshuva doesn't necessarily mean somebody who didn't grow up observant and became observant. It just means somebody who's a Bali Tshuva, who came back, returned closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. B'makom, Shabali Tshuva Omdim, Tzadikim Gemurim Einim Yecholim Lamod. The righteous, and it sounds like it means the stagnant righteous, they won't reach the place where the Bali Tshuva goes. Who's to say who's greater? Says the Gemara, sometimes the Bali Tshuva is greater than the Tzadik Gomor. Different roles doesn't mean better or worse. It just means different. Part of the problem, the Rabbonu Shel Olam decides.
Okay.
Part of the problem today is that immediately when people are different, we have to decide, well, who's better? The answer is, it's not one better than the other. It's just different, and that's okay. Different jobs for different people. It's a beautiful Kliyakar and a Rashi on the Pasuk in 19. Heim habedaber mel paro melech Mitzrayim. Who spoke to paro melech Mitzrayim? Lehotzi es bnei Yisrael Mitzrayim. Who? Moshe v'Aaron. So says Rashi, yesh mekomo shemakdim Aaron leMoshe. Sometimes we put Aaron before Moshe. V'yesh mekomo shemakdim Moshe l'Aaron. Lo melecha sheshkulim ke'echad. Sometimes we put Moshe first and sometimes we put Aaron first. If I asked you in the street, I woke you up at 3 in the morning, who is more important? Moshe or Aaron?
I would say Moshe.
You would have said Moshe. Says the Chumash, not so fast.
I would have said, what are you calling me for?
Not so fast. And the Kliyakar of Ephraim of Lunchitz in 20 makes an amazing diuk in this Rashi. He says, what's the context here? Hamadabrim El Paro. Who's talking to Paro? Who did the talking?
Aaron.
Right. Aaron. But who does it put first?
Moshe.
Moshe. Because you might have thought, since Aaron is doing the talking, say he's more important, and Moshe's a nobody. Says the Chumash, no. Because without Moshe, Aaron couldn't do any talking. And vice versa. Who Aaron or Moshe? When the Moshe Rabbeinu comes to rescue the Jews, says who Aaron or Moshe? Because you would have thought, Moshe's the rescuer, Aaron's just a nachschlepper. No, not so fast. Who Aaron or Moshe? Because without Aaron, Moshe Rabbeinu, he's just spinning his wheels. So Aaron and Moshe, it's not one greater than the other. It's just different roles for different people. So now, if you talk about women's issues, so in that article that I sent you, Harel makes the point, which is one of the key points with which I disagree. He makes the point in this article that, in 21, I quoted just this little piece, it is fair to assert, three lines in, that the Jewish perception of the distinctive nature of women is on the whole harmful to women, and the practices traditional Judaism advocates are often discriminatory. Most importantly, the Jewish perception of women rests on the conviction that women have a lesser role in public life. Okay. So, according to Harel, we, in traditional Orthodox Judaism, discriminate against women. So I disagree with him. The fact that we have differentiated roles between men and women don't mean that we discriminate against women. If you believe that the measure by which we are going to determine discrimination or not depends on involvement in public life, then that's correct. But is that how we measure a meaningful life? Newspaper articles or public role or any particular given role? Absolutely not. Rav Soloveitchik has an incredible book. Now, I must tell you, I'm not from New York, so I never used this expression, but I remember kids who were from New York growing up, they used to have an expression. And the more I read from Rav Soloveitchik, I think the expression is true. They used to say, it's sick. You ever heard that?
It's what?
It's sick.
It's sick.
Yeah. They say that in Chicago. They say in Chicago. Yeah. The more you read from Rav Soloveitchik, and this comes from a book that was published of manuscripts and lectures that he gave posthumously called Family Redeemed, it's sick. It's just genius. It's just beyond genius. He has a very lengthy essay about marriage and the different roles between men and women. So I gave you just a couple of pieces. If you look here at 22, go to the second little spot here. There is no doubt that in the eyes of halacha, man and woman enjoy an equal status and have the same worth as far as their humanitas is concerned. Remember, the Rav knew Latin. I don't know any Latin. But I think that means humanity. Both were created in the image of God. Both joined the covenantal community at Sinai. Both are committed to our meta-historical destiny. Both crave and search for God, and with both he engages in a dialogue. The narrative in the Bible that both the male and the female were created in the image of God suffices to refute the Greek mythological misogynist tradition which found its echo in Socrates and late Hellenistic thought and in modern misogyny such as those of Arthur Schopenhauer, Otto Weininger, August Strindberg, Friedrich Nietzsche, and Soren Kierkegaard. At least I can pronounce the names. All right, the Rav knew these philosophers. Skipping a little further, man and woman are both worthy of communing with God, the highest form of human perfection and self-fulfillment. However, the halacha has discriminated between axiological equality pertaining to their divine essence and metaphysical uniformity at the level of the existential personal experience. Men and women are different personae, endowed with singular qualities and assigned distinct missions in life. Hence, axiological equality should not level up the uniqueness of these two sexual personalities. The contrast manifesting itself in tension and sympathy, in longing for and shying away from each other, and portraying a metaphysical cleavage in personal existence must not be eliminated. One of the main claims that you will hear out in the street today is that men and women have to be equal. But what that can mean, and what for many people it does mean, is not the same thing. What it can mean is men and women have the same value. That's true. And they deserve, by the way, that also relates to compensation. You know, if two people are doing the same labor, why does it matter whether it's a man or a woman? But the notion that they have to be the same, so that, says Rav Soloveitchik, is a travesty. They're different, and we should celebrate that difference. It doesn't mean that one is more important than the other. Because what's the measure of importance? It's in your relationship with God. It's in my ability, and now Rav Soloveitchik has a long discussion about this in many contexts, about the connection with God and the sacrificial action of giving up something to be close to God and redeeming oneself. He says that has nothing to do with whether a person is a man or a woman. That's equal. Adrabba, if you want to talk about prayer, which we could spend a whole session just separate on, we alluded to it last week about the Mechitza, Rav Soloveitchik thinks that publicity and the Shleach Tzibur is actually the antithesis of prayer. Because prayer is my opportunity to personally commune with God. So it's actually not a great thing. The fact to have somebody stand up on a bima and pray for me, especially in the old days when I didn't even know how to pray. What do you mean? That's the antithesis of what prayer is supposed to be. It has nothing to do with whether you're a man or woman. You can equally connect. And so that can shape our view in terms of, yes, either we agree that there are different roles for different groups of people, and the same is for men and for women, or we don't. You could say, according to Harel, that it's discriminatory. You could say, according to Rav Soloveitchik, it's two different missions. Now, no doubt, this role is going to be different in a public sphere than in a private sphere. And we have several marmakomos to illustrate that. We could spend many hours on that. But one thing to keep in mind, is an important distinction in this discussion, is the following difference between descriptive and prescriptive. Some sources that we have in tradition are prescriptive. They tell us what to do and how it should be. There are others that are descriptive. They don't tell us how it must be. They describe a particular reality. Well, that reality may be one time and one way in one generation, and a different time in a different generation could be something else.
For instance,
if you were to describe the role of a woman in a... if a rabbi were to write the role of a woman 1,800 years ago and to write it today, in terms of practically, it's a totally different story. I don't know how many women dentists there were 1,800 years ago. There weren't that many dentists, b'chlal. But my wife is a dentist. I don't think there were too many women dentists many years ago. There weren't. So the reality is different. It's not prescriptive whether a woman is or is not a dentist. It's just descriptive. There wasn't, and today there is. So that's an important distinction to always keep in mind when we're looking at different sources, which aspects are prescriptive, that halacha mandates what the role is, versus which aspects of tradition are descriptive. This is the way that it was, but not necessarily is that the way the halacha mandates that it always be, depending on the circumstance. So, a couple of sources to consider. 23. We know the pasuk tells us in Tehillim, Kol kavuda bas melech penima. All the honor of the princess is inside. And this is manifest in different ways. One interesting suggestion, one angle, comes from the Mishnah in Kiddushin, Daf Chaf Tes Amud Aleph, in Source 24, that mitzvah saseh shazman grama, positive time-bound mitzvos, anoshim chayovim, the noshim beturos. Men are obligated, and women are not obligated. Women don't have to perform mitzvah saseh shazman grama, but is that prescriptive? That they cannot? No, it's just prescriptive that they're not obligated, but they certainly may, like in my own house. My wife sits at the sukkah, and she hears the shofar, etc., etc. Finally, 25, most dark. Now, this Rambam is quite a contentious Rambam. I would say it's caused many quills to be broken and hundreds of bottles of ink to be spilled over it. Ein ma'amidin isha b'malchus. You cannot appoint a woman in the monarchy. Shenemar, as it says, alecha melech. You should appoint a king, says the Rambam based on the Sefri, v'lo malka, and not a queen. V'chein kol mesimo shebi Yisrael. All of the missions, all of the positions of authority in Israel, ein memanim b'hem ela ish. You only appoint a man. So there's a lot of discussion about, number one, whether this Rambam is accepted la'alacha, and number two, what does it mean that the Rambam says a position of authority only goes to a man? Now the Rambam, what's that? Right, so that's a good question, whether or not we should have a prime minister which is a woman. That's a good question. So these are all good questions. The Rambam himself obviously would acknowledge that that doesn't mean that a woman can never take a leadership position. The Rambam knows the Tanakh. The Pasuk tells us in Shoftim, in the beginning of the fourth chapter, Udvora Isha Neviyah, there was a woman who was a prophetess, her name was Devora, Eishas Lapidos, he Shoftas Yisrael Ba'isai. Now, whether she was a rabbinical judge or just a leader, it doesn't matter. But we know that women have played leadership roles throughout the generations. So how does this play out practically? So that's a good question. Every circumstance, every halakha question needs to be looked at both from a descriptive and prescriptive angle. But what's the role that we're talking about? What does it mean that we're saying that there are general roles between men and women? Why is it that we're saying that in general women are protected from a role in the public eye?
Modesty.
So, partially modesty, but not really. Rav Soloveitchik has an incredible hesped that I've quoted so many times since I've come to Chicago, so some of you probably know it by heart. He amplifies this hesped in the book that I mentioned before called Family Redeemed, but here is in the original, because in 1977, in the Tradition magazine, he published the hesped that he gave for his machatenister.
Who was his machatenister?
His daughter was married to Rav Yitzchak Asher Tversky. Rav Yitzchak Asher Tversky, also known as Professor Dr. Isidore Tversky of Harvard, was the Tolliner Rebbe, the son of the previous Tolliner Rebbe and Tolliner Rebbetzin. So the Tolliner Rebbetzin was the machatenister of Rav Soloveitchik. When she passed away, he gave a magnificent hesped that you can get in Tradition article. If you'd like, I can send you that as well. So I gave you a little piece here where he describes a little bit about what he's talking about. The difference between what they call in the Family Redeemed, motherhood and fatherhood. Again, these are typologies. They're not assigned, but you'll see they reflect a general trend. Somebody want to read starting from the top here on source 27? I admit. All right, pretend you're Rav Soloveitchik giving the hesped.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I admit that I'm not able to define precisely the messianic role, excuse me, of the Jewish mother. Only by circumscription I hope to be able to explain it. Permit me to draw upon my own experiences. I used to have long conversations with my mother. In fact, it was a monologue rather than a dialogue. She talked, and I happened to overhear. What did she talk about? I must use an halachic term in order to answer the question. She talked me, Inyana Dioma.
Exactly.
I used
Inyana Dioma means the theme of the day.
Okay. I used to watch her arranging the house in honor of a holiday. I used to see her recite prayers. I used to watch her recite the Sidra every Friday night. And I still remember the nostalgic tune I learned from her very much.
Okay. I usually get goosebumps now, and I'm starting to get them a little bit, because he's about to tell you something extraordinary. One of the greatest Jewish minds, rabbinic scholars of the last century, and then you can figure out how much more on your own, is about to tell you something astonishing. Go ahead.
Most of all, I learned that Judaism expresses itself not only in formal compliance with the law, but also in a living experience. She taught me that there is a flavor, a scent, and warmth to mitzvot. I learned from her the most important thing in life.
Hold on. You ready? This is incredible, right? This is unbelievable. It was worth coming out tonight just for this one line. Here we go.
To feel the presence of the Almighty and the gentle pressure of His hand resting upon my frail shoulders.
That's it. Go ahead.
Without her teachings, which quite often were transmitted to me in silence, I would have grown up a soulless being, dry and insensitive.
Can't believe it.
The laws of Shabbos, for instance, were passed down to me by my father. They are part of a Musar
Avicha.
Avicha, okay. The Shabbos is a living entity. As a queen was revealed to me by my mother, it is a part of Torah Imecha. The fathers knew much about the Shabbat. The mother lived the Shabbat, experienced her presence, and perceived her beauty and splendor.
Beautiful.
The father, you didn't finish.
Believe that. Rav Soloveitchik says, I can't tell you exactly what it is, but there's a fundamental difference. We know that women, we're speaking in typologies, not all women are mothers, but in general, women have a certain nurturing quality that's inborn. That's part of what it means to be an aim. The word aim and the word emunah are related. It has to do with a certain feeling, a certain emotion. Umah, a nation, that goes through the mother. If you want to know who's Jewish and who's not, you got to check for the mother. Because that's where the kishkas are. That's the experience of Yiddishkeit. That's not the formal compliance. That's not the legal... It's the heart of it. So you want to know, says Rav Soloveitchik, where the accent is? The accent for the women is in creating this heart, creating this environment, which primarily is going to be in the home. That's why it's called Akeras Abayis. That's the mainstay of the home. So when I was discussing this with my mother-in-law, who, as you know, I've quoted many times, so she said to me, she's heard an amazing pshat, which I didn't hear from somebody, I didn't remember who she said it from. We know that women are not, they are not admitted as witnesses in a court of Jewish law in general.
Why?
Why? Great question. Now, is it because women are not trustworthy? No. In fact, if you want to know why you can eat something, if I give it to you, let's say, imagine I offer you a cup of soda, and you didn't know what was in it, but you can trust me. How can you trust me? Because the Pasuk says about a woman who counts the Nida cycle, that she, the Safra law, she counts. She counts. And not only that, we trust her. Nobody else has trustworthiness in the Torah except for the woman counting. That's it. And the rabbis in the Talmud say, well, if we trust the woman with counting, so it means we trust her with kashrus also. If we trust the women, we should probably trust the men also. So everybody's trustworthiness is learned from the fact that the Torah empowers women and men to be trustworthy. What is it? So my mother said a good shot, because I forget who she said it from. We have a halacha, and that means if you know, it says the following, if you know testimony about someone, you could be subpoenaed to appear in court of law. And you could violate an iser if you don't, called im lo yagid. So what could happen? A woman could be under duress to appear in a public court, and it could make her uncomfortable. So therefore the Torah says, She's not responsible.
I thought she can give testimony privately. She can come to her privately, so, not in court.
Not in general court cases. There are many instances where a woman's word will be accepted as credibility, but not in the formal testimony. There's a difference between edus and emunus, which is a long story. But the idea that the woman is protected from outside obligations, like... I can tell you that there have been several women who have commented to me that they are very quite content that they don't have to get up every single morning at 6:30 in the morning and go to Shacharis. How could you expect somebody who is obligated in time-bound mitzvos and constantly under the pressure of time to be able to nurture this environment? The musar avicha, the strictness of the punctilious nature of the halacha, that's something that's extremely demanding in terms of time, and it doesn't allow as much for the cultivation. Says Rav Soloveitchik, it's two totally different things. So the women's mesora is to be able to cultivate this culture, this environment, this Yiddishkeit. Where does this come from? So Rav Soloveitchik has in another piece, in the first piece, if you go back to 22, which I'm not going to read inside, he goes back to an earlier concept. You know, let's just read it just very briefly, quickly, to the fact that it's part of the way that Hashem, so to speak, is himself. I ask you, is God masculine or feminine? The answer is, he's both. Sometimes he's referred to our father, sometimes he's referred to as our mother. The sexual community is also a fellowship of two unique personalities incarnating two aspects of reality. The Kabbalah based its doctrine of bipersonalism upon the verse, and God created man in his own image, in the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. How can we reconcile these two prima facie contradictory statements? Man was created in the image of God, and man is a dual being. The answer to this question was offered by the Kabbalist. Sexual differentiation expresses more than a physical property. It manifests in ontic contrast, a dual aspect within the essence of creation, something deeper and more fundamental. Say the Kabbalists, and some people say this when they're about to do a mitzvah, L'shem yichud kud shabrichu l'yachei shchina and kud shabrichu. Two aspects of the vine. One is called shchina. Shchina is feminine. And kud shabrichu, that's masculine. And the Kabbalists have a whole world of teaching about these different aspects of shchina. Kud shabrichu. Literally means God bless him. The Holy One, blessed be he. Yeah, exactly. HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So in Aramaic, it's called Kud Shabrichu. So if you ever look in the Siddur, in one of those Hinini Muchan and Mezuman, they'll mention Liyache, to connect, to bring together the Shechina and Kud Shabrichu and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Those two aspects of the divine. One has to do with immanence, one has to do with transcendence. That's a whole Torah in and of itself. So these two ways of being, says Rav Soloveitchik, of feminine and masculine, of Shechina and Kud Shabrichu, are manifest in the world in which we live. So these two modes of operating, the two missions of men and women, respectively, each play a critical role. They're both essential to creating a holistic Jewish society and a Jewish person. Now, how does this play out practically in any given circumstance, in terms of what a woman's role is going to be given a particular question? So that depends on every community and every time and every place. We have to figure out, first of all, what is the halacha? We have to know the halacha. We have to know the context. Every question we're going to have to know. So one thing to consider, I'll give you an example. There's a question about whether women recite Kaddish or not. There's a big debate about whether or not women recite Kaddish. So one of the most important sources on this is the Shuvas Chavis Yor, which you have in page 20, in source 26. It's Rav Yoyer Chaim Bachrach from Germany, 1600s in Germany. He was asked about a man who lived in Amsterdam, who died, and he had no sons. And he paid people, 10 men, to come to his home to learn every day. And afterwards, the daughter, when the house, would say the Kaddish. Says Rav Yoyer Bachrach, and this Tshuva has been used in different angles, both by those who have, by rabbis who have argued that halachically women do say Kaddish and those who don't say Kaddish, depending on how you apply this Tshuva. Rav Yoyer Bachrach says, before I discuss anything, I have to point out to you there's something very important called a minhag. That's something that needs to be taken into consideration. What is a minhag? What is the custom in this particular community? What's the Jewish custom? Jewish customs are not just, they're not just, I don't know, parade costumes that come and go. These are important hallowed traditions. So that's one thing to consider. Another thing to consider are other variables, other factors, and that's the piece Rav Lichtenstein writes at the end in 28. Hashelahi, the question is, Be'ezo mida rotzim lahansiach es hamatzav ha'atchalti ha'kayam ba'halacha ulishanos oso bedrochim helchatios re'legitimiot. When do you apply the halachic precedent of what was, which is often descriptive, and when do you say, no, it's going to change based on the circumstances within a legitimate halachic circumstance? He gives an example. It's not just a women's question. Mechiras chametz. Go back 500 years, no one sold their chametz. In Europe, the only people who sold their chametz were the liquor store owners. Because if they would have to throw away all their chametz, they would have no parnasa. Then it became popular that everybody sold their chametz. There's a thing called a prus bull. What's a prus bull? A prus bull is when the Shemitah comes along, usually all debts are annulled. But Hillel came along and said, no, I have an idea. We're going to write a special document. We're going to give it to the rabbinic court. Let's say, Mrs. M, let's say I owe you $1 million. So Shemitah comes along. It's gone. So you know what? You're going to write a prus bull. I'm going to sign it. We're going to write a prus bull. We're going to sign it. Give it to the rabbinic court. I still owe you $1 million. What do you mean? You just upended all the laws of Shemitah's Ksafim. So how did they do that? So he made a special document to do an end around. So why? Why do you do that?
Society.
Oh. So I once heard a beautiful insight in this from Rabbi Michael Rosenzweig, one of my Rosh Yeshiva and why he pointed out that these halachic inventions are not minimizing Yiddishkeit. They're maximizing Yiddishkeit. How? Because on the one hand, we're doing an end around on the mitzvah of Shemitah. On the other hand, Hillel said, I'm concerned about another mitzvah we read about in last week's parasha called Im Kesef Tal Ve'esami. You have to loan the people who are in need. And what will happen, says Hillel, I see what's happening. If I know the end of 7 years, I'll never get my money back?
Forget it.
Forget about it. So therefore, Hillel said, for the religious value of loans, I'm going to sacrifice, I'm going to, in a legitimate halachic way. Now, I'm not saying I'm going to ignore halacha. I'm going to sacrifice one level of fulfillment by circumventing halacha. So that's going to be the case in many questions. We have to think about, what are the values? Sometimes, feelings are important. The Gemara has an interesting discussion about smicha, resting your hands on a karban. There's a discussion in the Gemara whether women do smicha or not. Well, one opinion is that women do not do smicha based on a drasha, that women don't do smicha. But the Gemara comments that there was a tradition that women did a similar type of thing. They didn't actually do smicha, rest their hands on the animal. They would come to the animal and move their hands around, I guess like Shabbos candles. Mm-hmm. The Gemara says, why did they do that? Akufi yadaychu. Because it says, k'dei la'asos nachas ruach l'nashim. To make them feel part of it, to make them feel empowered. They didn't compromise the halacha. They didn't have the women put their hands. So now there's always a discussion. When is it part of the minig? When is it not part of the minig? What are the different values at play? What are the different factors? What are the motivations? What's our motivation here? Is it a religious motivation? Is it being close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Or is it a self-serving motivation? Every circumstance needs to be looked at independently. And I think if we use these as the contours, as the approach, I think we can have a more healthy and balanced look at every issue that comes up when it comes to women's roles in public life. And it'll depend on every society, on every time, and every place. You can't apply, it's not one size fits all. Every case you have to look at independently. Every issue needs to be looked at independently through the prism, I think, of the issues that we have discussed and we have presented. So hopefully this will give us something more to think about as we look forward.
So what's the answer with the women at the back of the bus?
So, good question. So like I said at the beginning, it's a complicated matter. It's a complicated matter. It'll depend on the particular society. My own personal feeling is that today, now I can't tell you what I think anybody else should do, but I think for me, if we're going to have segregated buses, which we could choose to do that, I would think that we should not put women in the back of the bus. And I'll tell you why. Because whether or not it's better for the women to be in the back or not in the back, in today's milieu, you know what women in the back of the bus smells like? What did that feel like?
Rosa Parks.
Exactly, Rosa Parks. So we have to be sensitive to the fact that if we tell women to go to the back of the bus, they're going to feel like Rosa Parks. We should send the men to the back of the bus. You know, we want to keep it separate, have a mechitza down the middle, send the men to the back of the bus and put up a partition if we don't want them to see.
Yeah,
that's
partition
fine.
Partition in the middle.
Whatever it's going to be. But my point is that we, again, maybe the people who are running these buses never heard of Rosa Parks. That's very possible.
Sure.
But for us, we need to understand the society and the culture in which we live and what the feelings are going to be that are going to be generated by the different practices that we have. So even though, yes, we spoke about the fact that in many circumstances, separate seating is appropriate, but sometimes we pointed out last week that mixed seating is appropriate, depending on the venue, depending on the circumstance. Every case needs to be looked at through the prism of Torah, through the prism of values, of religious motivation, of minhag, of halacha, all those factors combined. So thank God we have a very talented and great leaders, rabbinic leaders in every generation who can help us, guide us through those issues. Okay?